had it or hit it, Joe Biden?
Hit it. You know, honestly, here's the thing. I think sometimes people want electoral politics to be, we overly identify with, it's like, if you vote for someone, they have to be the embodiment of you. There are plenty of things that the president does that I completely disagree with. I think, you know, right now what's happening in Gaza, I can't go on every single day seeing this. I don't associate myself with what's happening. But at the end of the day, we have to acknowledge that we just can't allow this fascist movement to grow in this country. If it's coming down to this next election, for me personally, the decision to vote is not a difficult one for me, because, like, just because I'm voting for him doesn't mean that he embodies everything about me.
Right.
That's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being interviewed on the talk show Hotspot on January 22nd, 2024, explaining why she will vote for Joe Biden, even though she completely disagrees with how he's handling Gaza. Because by her logic, voting for Biden is a vote against fascism. In this episode, we want to talk again about fascism because we have entered a primary election cycle where leftists of all stripes will once again be cajoled, harassed, and even trolled by the neoliberal establishment to vote blue no matter who in order to avoid Donald Trump and quote-unquote fascism. And many liberals feel entitled to attack leftists at election time because by their shallow liberal definition, fascism is simply a right-wing ideology that is embodied only by Donald Trump. But what the liberal establishment fails to understand time and time again is that fascism is not just an ideological project, but an economic and political project, which is the inevitable result of decades of working class repression under neoliberal capitalism. So we want to define fascism for you as we are using it in this podcast. We know it's a word that has become almost meaningless. It's been thrown around all the time without any consistency. But for the purposes of our podcast, we are using Marxist sociologist William I. Robinson's definition of 21st century fascism as, quote, the triangulation of transnational capital fused with reactionary political power in the state, along with neo-fascist forces in civil society, end quote. When we understand that fascism is a global capitalist project, one that fuses with state political power, we begin to see past these shallow notions of fascism that are just about right-wing ideology or authoritarianism. There are authoritarians all over the world who aren't fascists, and right-wing ideology is just one dimension of fascism. Remember, it's a triangle: transnational capital, state power, and ideology in civil society. In 2024, we live in an economy where transnational monopolies have extreme political power and influence over our governments and our nation states. This is an economy where the working class has been severely repressed for decades, where labor unions have been suppressed or co-opted. It's an economy where there are no viable socialist or communist political parties, only capitalist parties. And any party that is not capitalist is routinely scorned, ridiculed, and marginalized. Under this global political economy, the left has not been able to offer up any real revolutionary political alternatives for decades. And we are stuck inside a counter-revolutionary political cycle that points towards fascism. So whether we elect more Democrats or Republicans, they will always side with capitalism and big business over the working class. All over the world, we're ending up with more and more presidents, congresses, and parliaments who have become puppets of transnational capital. They do the bidding of the military-industrial complex, the bidding of the fossil fuel industry. And this leads to glaring social and economic inequalities, with huge concentrations of wealth at the very top of societies and mass poverty at the bottom, all over the world. And this poverty, in turn, breeds class war and class resentment, which then creates the perfect breeding ground for the fascist ideologies to take hold. It's a vicious cycle. So when we understand this triangle of transnational capital, state power, and right-wing ideology, a lot of things in the world start to make sense. The Trumps, the Bolsonaros, and the Netanyahus of the world, what do they have in common? They're not just right-wingers. They are taking state power and utilizing the state in order to advance the needs of transnational capitalism. And Biden is doing the same thing. He may not embody the same right-wing rhetoric as Trump, but he's using the state to advance transnational capitalist interests while continuing to repress the working class. So no, AOC, voting for Joe Biden will not stop fascism. He, along with most corporate Democrats, are actually paving the road to fascism. And until we address the economic dimension of fascism, we will never be able to stop its rampant and insidious spread. So today we're looking again at 21st century fascism through the lens of the military-industrial complex and how this complex is profiting off this horrific genocide in Palestine.
Before we get started, we want to thank our Patreon donors. Thanks for listening to Crawdads and Taters. Please support our work at patreon.com/crawdadsandtaters. Thank you to William Huffman, Todd Munson, Old Left, Kenny Jones, Janae Saliba, Greta Hunicky, Brad Sundahl, and our VIP rebels Ben Andrews, Liz Font, and Daryl. Thank you so much for supporting us. We couldn't do this without your support.
Twenty-five years ago, I made a film called Palestine is Still the Issue. It was about a nation of people, the Palestinians, forced off their land and later subjected to a military occupation by Israel. An occupation condemned by the United Nations and almost every country in the world, including Britain. But Israel is backed by a very powerful friend, the United States. So in 25 years, if we're to speak of the great injustice here, nothing has changed.
That was the great John Pilger, who died at the age of 84 on December 30th, 2023. Pilger was an Australian journalist whose independent and groundbreaking work on such topics as Vietnam, Cambodia, Iraq, and Palestine shed light on the horrors of U.S. foreign policy. He was also a huge advocate for Aboriginal rights in Australia, and he twice won the Journalist of the Year Award from the British Press. He survived multiple death threats and attempts on his life, and he was hated by top U.S. government officials. We could certainly use more journalists like him today.
Yes, we definitely could.
We titled this episode after a Lenin quote, "Capitalist Horrors Without End," in honor of the 100-year anniversary of Lenin's death, one of the greatest revolutionaries of world history. But before getting into our analysis, let's do a quick update on the numbers of people killed during this genocide, since it's been a while since our last episode.
On this 107th day of the barbaric assault on Palestine, from October 7th to January 21st, the day we recorded this episode, the official death toll in Gaza reported from the Gaza Health Ministry is 25,474 Palestinians dead, while another 62,681 have been wounded. There are many thousands of people missing and presumed dead under the rubble because authorities cannot reach them. And this genocidal war is not confined to Gaza. In the occupied West Bank, at least 369 people have been killed, including more than 95 children, and more than 4,000 have been injured. And two-thirds of the dead in Gaza and the West Bank are women and children.
The Israeli death toll from the Hamas attacks on October 7th remains at 1,139, which is about 300 less than they had originally claimed after journalists discovered that Israel had inflated the numbers in the first place. And Israel has some 8,730 injured. As of January 18th, according to UNRWA, 1.7 million Palestinians were estimated to be internally displaced. Many of them have been displaced multiple times, as families have been forced to move repeatedly in search of safety. The ability of UNRWA to provide humanitarian support and updated data on the numbers of internally displaced people has been severely restricted due to the mass displacement of almost everyone. And according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, that's the IPC, 2.2 million people are at imminent risk of famine at this moment.
So that's everyone in Gaza.
Yep, because
2.2 million.
That's everyone.
The population is 2.2 to 2.3 million people. So that's, it's a, man-made famine created by Israel. We've given all of you a lot of numbers here, which we have to take with a grain of salt. We know that the deaths in Gaza come from the Gaza Health Ministry. The Gaza Health Ministry reports deaths that have been verified with people's names and identifying information. But we know that there are thousands upon thousands of people whose bodies were destroyed beyond recognition, and many more who haven't yet been found. So these official death tolls that are coming out, we know they're a gross undercount of how many people have actually died. Here's Ralph Nader on Democracy Now! On January 5th.
And the fatality count is grossly undercounted, Amy. I know you refer to the official Hamas health authority count, where they only count people whose names they know who died. And so it's over 22,000, 58,000 injury. This is a massive undercount. As the head of the Global Health Department, University of Edinburgh, said in an article in The Guardian the other day, there's going to be 500,000 Gazans who are going to die before the end of this year, not only from the bombing, but from the effect of the bombing in terms of the destruction of the healthcare system, infectious diseases, the polluted water, diarrhea, which little children, which is often a high rate of fatality and very quickly, lack of any food, no shelter, 85% of the 2.3 million people homeless. They have no connection to sanitation, food, protection, the winter elements. Estimate now is at least 100,000 have died, and more will die every day because of the effects that I've just described. The World Health Organization said they've never seen a situation like this in decades. The amount of number of children being killed in November, it was 150 a day from the Israeli bombing, and that's compared to two a day in Afghanistan and less than one a day in Ukraine.
Well, that doesn't really surprise me. I mean, these numbers are always undercounts. And as you were saying earlier, Taters, the fact that the Gaza Health Ministry only counts people who are recognizable. We know that there are thousands that aren't recognizable. And then we know there are thousands and thousands more who are missing.
Yeah, and some outlets report over 30,000 dead. And over 100,000 total missing, injured, and dead. And like Ralph Nader said, it's probably closer to over 100,000 dead at this point.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to reach that much, or even up to 500,000, like you said, which is, you know, that's absurd. It's, you know, this is genocide. This is just clearly genocide.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, in addition to the humans who have been brutally murdered by Israel, who are, like we said, mainly women and children, two-thirds women and children, almost entirely civilians. Israel likes to claim that every male killed over the age of like 14 was an enemy combatant, but we know that's not true. We know they are civilians. The entirety of Gaza as a city has been largely obliterated. The Financial Times reports that Gaza is one of the most heavily bombed places in human history. Schools, hospitals, and UN refugee camps have been routinely and systematically bombed. According to the Wall Street Journal, quote, by mid-December, Israel had dropped 29,000 bombs, munitions, and shells on the strip, end quote.
29,000 bombs. Oh my God. And now we're in January. That was a mid-December quote. So these numbers have obviously increased as Israel has not stopped their bombing or ground campaign. And the total tonnage of bombs, get this. If you haven't heard this statistic, brace yourself. The total tonnage of bombs is well over that of the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan in 1945, including both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Wall Street Journal has said that, quote, the damage is comparable in scale to the most devastating urban warfare in the modern record, end quote.
Yeah, that is terrible. And that's, you know, think about what we did to Vietnam. And this is worse than that. And Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, all the bombing campaigns the U.S. has carried out, Israel is doing far worse.
Far more than that.
Nearly 70% of Gaza's 439,000 homes and about half of its buildings have been damaged or destroyed. Clean water infrastructure is just gone. More than half of water, sanitation, and hygiene facilities have been damaged or destroyed, which means that waterborne diseases are soaring, while cases of scabies, lice, chickenpox, skin rashes, and respiratory infections are also climbing.
And in terms of communications with the outside world, internet and cell infrastructure is only occasionally present now. And in terms of hospitals, only 9 out of 36 hospitals in Gaza were still open in early January. And these hospitals are functioning without water, fuel, electricity, or really any kind of medicine. Can you imagine a hospital functioning without water or electricity? Can you even imagine that? Or medicine? So amputations are being routinely performed on children especially and other patients without any anesthesia. Doctors are working 24 hours a day without any basic supplies. So, of course, mass graves are piling up all around the hospitals.
As we've discussed in previous episodes, the corporate media, along with the Western imperialist media, wants you to think that history began on October 7th, 2023. However, we start our history timeline from the UN partition in 1948, which followed the British partition. When 56% of Palestine was allocated to the Jewish state, despite the Palestinian Arab population numbering twice the Jewish population. In 1948, the Nakba happened. Israel declared independence, it expelled 750,000 Palestinians, and conducted over 50 massacres. Then, in defiance of the United Nations, Israel claimed even more land than the UN partition had granted them. So 1948 was just the beginning of Israel's decades-long ethnic cleansing program. It's a legal occupation of Palestine, according to dozens of reports from the UN. It's apartheid state and its ongoing settler colonialism project that has now defined this region for the last 75 years.
In order to understand the genocide that's going on today, we have thus far focused on the history that starts with the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, because the creation of Zionism is where the roots of this genocide can be found. And unlike Zionist and Western imperial propaganda, where history starts on October 7th, 2023, the history that we teach here is based on material reality. It's not based on arguments around who's entitled to this land under what religious argument. The fact is that Christians, Muslims, and Jews can all make the argument that this is their homeland. And it is true that Palestinian Jews and Palestinian Christians have inhabited this land for hundreds of years alongside the Arab Muslim majority. In fact, they lived relatively peacefully together for several hundred years during and after the Ottoman Empire and prior to 1948, before the British and UN partitions.
As Marxists, we don't focus on ideology or religion. We see the world through a lens called historical materialism. This is the practice of understanding social and political relations through power dynamics that originate from material conditions. Who owns the wealth? Who owns the property? Who controls the means of production? Who benefits from the empire? Who is exploited? These are the real material conditions on the ground. As Karl Marx said in the 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, quote, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past," end quote.
And Engels said in the famous Marxist text, Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific, quote, "The materialist conception of history starts from the proposition that in every society that has appeared in history, the manner in which wealth is distributed and society divided into classes or orders is dependent upon what is produced, how it is produced, and how the products are exchanged. From this point of view, the final causes of all social changes and political revolutions are to be sought not in men's brains, not in men's better insights into eternal truth and justice, but in changes in the modes of production and exchange. They are to be sought not in philosophy, but in the economics of each particular epoch. End quote.
This is an excellent description of historical materialism. Thank you, Frederick Engels.
Getting back to fascism. As we know, fascism is becoming a bigger and bigger threat around the world, especially within crumbling empires like the United States and Israel. Here in the United States, we've been watching figures like Donald Trump leading the ideological charge towards fascism, while most corporate Democrats bend over backwards to capitulate financially, politically, and otherwise to ensure that fascism gains a foothold, while utterly failing to protect the working class, the environment, and even taking the lead on imperial projects abroad.
For example, the Biden regime has been more imperialist than the Trump regime, even though Trump's rhetoric is more ideologically fascist. But the Biden regime has continued building Trump's border wall, caging families on the U.S.-Mexico border, increasing oil drilling projects, and expanding the record-high U.S. military budget, exceeding $1 trillion, while U.S. taxpayers watch their government spend billions of dollars in Palestine, slaughtering mainly children and women, and men, by the tens of thousands.
Meanwhile, at home, the U.S. working class is poorer than ever. The U.S. poverty rate saw its largest one-year increase in history, according to new 2022 data from the U.S. Census. Two-thirds of U.S. Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Child poverty also more than doubled in 2022. Record inflation rates have crushed the U.S. working class. Also in 2022, approximately 49 million people, that's one in six in this country, still rely on food assistance. That is, one-sixth are food insecure. And in 2023, the Biden administration cut the COVID emergency benefits, kicking over 500,000 people off of SNAP.
That's awful. And that is what Biden is doing. Let's not forget about the 3.8 million people who have been kicked off of Medicaid since Biden declared an end to the COVID-19 pandemic.
And we know that the pandemic is now, like, on the rise again, that COVID has horrible numbers at this very moment in history, but too bad you don't have Medicaid anymore. Sorry, folks.
Yeah, if you get COVID and you don't have health care and you need to go to the hospital, I mean, how many people are going to die because they didn't want to go to the hospital? Just, yeah, because they're afraid of hospital bills.
Right.
But the Democrats rigged the primary to make sure the guy who once upon a time believed in Medicare for all would never win. And we've also seen a record increase in homelessness, a 12% jump in 2023. Which means that 2023 holds the record for the highest number of people reported as experiencing homelessness on a single night since the reporting began in 2007.
Wow.
And that was 653,100 people who were homeless on a single night in January of 2023. And here we are a year later, so I expect that number has to have increased since then.
Of course.
They haven't released the 2024 numbers, but I just, with record evictions, I don't see it going anywhere but up.
We know which direction this is going. So how are Americans in the United States feeling about this giant economic squeeze?
Well, I don't feel good about it.
No, we definitely do not feel good about it. None of our friends feel good about it. Everyone we know doesn't feel good about it. But then again, we aren't part of the wealthy elite. So according to a Mind Over Money survey by Capital One and the Decision Lab, 77% of Americans report feeling anxious about their financial situation. Sounds about right.
That would be us.
That'd be pretty much everybody. 58% feel that finances control their lives. Yep. And 52% have difficulty controlling their money-related worries. So there's more anxiety disorders, in other words, as a result of these financial woes. Roughly half of respondents say they feel fatigued, find it difficult to concentrate at work, and have trouble sleeping. And a quarter of respondents said that this financial stress affects their relationships. So, folks, people are struggling.
Yeah, wow. And this has been happening while the richest 1% grabbed nearly two-thirds of all new wealth worth $42 trillion that has been created since 2020.
The richest 1% grabbed nearly two-thirds of all new wealth since 2020.
Yeah. This 1% hold almost twice as much money as the bottom 99% of the world's population, which was revealed in a recent Oxfam report. And also according to CNN Business, the top 1% captured nearly twice as much new wealth as the rest of the world over the last 2 years. So this is record inequality.
And these are the kinds of economic trends we see that are consistent with a rise in global fascism. So let's look at inequality in Israel through the same lens. We know that the Netanyahu regime is an extreme right-wing regime with ideological fascist tendencies. We see this in its openly genocidal rhetoric towards Palestinians, which has only gotten worse and more blatant in recent years. But in terms of the movement towards financial fascism, we also see the Israeli ruling elites getting richer and richer with U.S. support, while the poor within Israel are getting poorer and more numerous. Sounds like a familiar economic model.
Yeah.
So in terms of Netanyahu's riches, we know that he's been wanted on corruption charges since 2019 for fraud and bribery, having received lavish presents from a prominent Israeli Hollywood producer and an Australian billionaire businessman.
That sounds like capitalism to me. Corruption at the top. Are we familiar with this somewhere else? United States?
Everywhere in the world?
And yeah, we shouldn't be surprised by this corruption in Israel at all. You know, it might be the only democracy in the Middle East.
Quote, unquote.
But it is a thoroughly capitalist society, and capitalism always results in class disparities. According to the Israeli National Insurance Institute's 2021 report on poverty and social gaps in the country, almost 2 million Israelis live in poverty, which is a little over 20% of the population.
20%? That's like, wow. Compared to, I think, 12% of the U.S. population?
Yeah, that's, you know, the U.S. is bad, but Israel is even worse when it comes to poverty.
Wow.
And this number of 2 million is 0.5% higher than the previous year, with over a fifth of Israelis living below the poverty threshold.
Wow. Another statistic, 1 in 4 households in Israel, 26%, were unable to cover all monthly expenses in 2021. And even worse, 1/3 of Israeli Holocaust survivors live in poverty. I find this statistic to be incredibly revealing, given that politically, Israel uses the victimization of Jews during the Holocaust as its main political and ideological justification for Zionist expansionist projects and the ongoing genocide that it has been carrying out in Palestine. But when it comes to how Israel actually treats its own Holocaust survivors, they are the poorest group in Israel.
And so these are all like fairly old people by this point.
Right.
You know, 1945 was the end of World War II and the Holocaust. So they're treating their elderly terribly.
Mm-hmm.
Who suffered, you know, they were probably children during the Holocaust or young adults.
Totally traumatized people.
Yeah. And today, instead of being respected, they're just...
And honored.
Living in poverty.
Amazing.
And, you know, in contrast to the grinding poverty suffered by 20% of all Israelis, and like we said, 1/3 of these Holocaust survivors... Tremendous wealth in Israel is concentrated in a few hundred people. According to Forbes, 77% of the richest 500 people in the country are billionaires. This number jumped in the last decade when they were fewer than half. In the last 20 years, the wealth of these 500 grew tenfold. That's incredible.
Wow.
Like, this disparity.
Wow.
And we talk about the poverty in Israel, but... The plight of the Palestinians living under occupation and apartheid in Gaza, in the West Bank, is much, much worse.
Yeah. After 16 years of an economic blockade, UNRWA reports that, quote, 81.5% of individuals in Gaza live below the national poverty line. 81.5. 71% of occupied Palestine are refugees, displaced, or descendants of those displaced during the Nakba.
And this is before the bombing.
Yeah,
this is 2022.
This is 2022.
I just want to be clear that this is
yep.
This is not as a result of the latest genocidal bombing.
Right. 64% are food insecure. The unemployment rate in 2021 stood at 47%. That's almost half. With the overall youth unemployment rate at 64%. In 2020, the per capita GDP stood at US$1,049, which is four times lower than the West Bank and Jordan. As a consequence, today, 80% of the population depends on humanitarian assistance. It would have to. And among them are 1.1 million Palestinian refugees receiving food assistance from UNRWA, up from just 80,000 in 2000. So that was a normal day way back in 2022 before this massive bombing campaign began.
Wow, that's just unheard of poverty rates in both Israel and Palestine.
Yep.
We've seen throughout history that this kind of economic inequality creates a political backdrop for fascism. Just like the fascist movements of Germany, Spain, and Italy in the 1930s, there were economic conditions that gave rise to these fascist movements. And those conditions were the collapsing economies of these nations after World War I. For example, Germany owed war reparations of 132 billion gold marks.
Wow.
Which is roughly 269 billion US dollars today. And this debt meant that they were unable to spend on rebuilding their own economy. So by 1923, the German mark had no value. This financial crisis, as all financial crises do, absolutely crushed the working class.
Yeah, that's a great historical model to look back on. We can compare this history to the present economics of the United States today. The devastating inflation we have is in part because our U.S. economy is in decline. Corporations are raising prices because the value of the U.S. dollar is falling. And yet the ultra-capitalists have designed it so that they will keep getting richer and richer, even while the working class and poor suffer more and more. This is also the logical result of 40-plus years of neoliberalism. But these economic conditions create a lot of mental and emotional suffering, which sadly makes the population, both in the case of Germany and in the United States today, more amenable to right-wing ideologies that explain away and scapegoat their suffering onto another group of people. It's no coincidence that we see rising levels of vitriol against Black and Brown people, against refugees coming into the United States on the U.S.-Mexico border, against the LGBTQ community, against women and their reproductive rights, against socialists, against diversity in education. At the very same time, we are seeing Israel's government becoming more and more genocidal and vitriolic toward Palestinians, both in rhetoric and in action.
And a similar situation existed in Italy after World War I. The lira lost value as inflation soared. There was a massive upsurge in strikes throughout the country. It was this that led to the industrialists backing Mussolini's fascist party, which focused on breaking the leftist trade unions and socialist and communist parties. With the backing of big capital, militant fascist groups attacked workers, socialists, and communists in the streets. This alliance with the Italian political right led to membership in the fascist party soaring from 1,000 members during the war to 250,000 members in 1921. By the end of 1922, the fascists had eliminated most of the socialist and trade unions and seized power after marching on Rome.
So what you're saying is that Mussolini allied with big corporations as well as social conservatives to attack and kill the left?
Absolutely.
Well, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, Mussolini's fascist party allied with more traditional conservatives brought together by their anti-Marxist sentiments. And Mussolini took on some of their social characteristics, such as supporting the Catholic Church, relegating women to the role of childbearing, banning abortion and birth control, and supporting free enterprise.
So here again, we see the marriage of the economic and the ideological forms of fascism. There's an economic crisis, and then capitalists ally with the far right, often the religious right, to eliminate working class movements and any movement that supports marginalized groups in order to enable the expansion of corporate control. This is definitely happening today in the United States, and it's happening in Israel. And I would argue that as we enter a more and more multipolar world with the Chinese economy on the rise, the United States and the global North more generally are going to fight their loss of geopolitical and economic control by waging more and more wars.
And I would agree. You know, several Marxist theorists have commented on late-stage capitalism's tendency toward empire and militarism. Capitalism also expresses itself through imperialism outside of the nation-state. Two very famous Marxists, Vladimir Lenin and Rosa Luxemburg, both wrote about imperialism and militarism in relation to late-stage capitalism in the late 19th and early 20th century. And Harvard graduate and Marxist economists Paul Sweezy and Paul Baran wrote a book called Monopoly Capitalism in 1966, notably dedicating it to Che Guevara. And another modern-day Marxist sociologist, William I. Robinson, who we've quoted before in this podcast, understands this late stage of capitalism and imperialism to be part of a larger movement toward global fascism.
It's fascinating. We just have all these theorists, both historically and even recently, talking about imperialism and fascism, and yet you just never hear anything about that from the corporate media, of course. Of course.
Yeah, they're not going to report what, you know, someone like Lenin said.
Right.
Or they don't even want us to know who Rosa Luxemburg was.
Right. And Lenin wrote a famous book called Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, where he explains, quote, "Imperialism is capitalism at that stage of development at which the dominance of monopolies and finance capital is established, in which the export of capital has acquired pronounced importance, in which the division of the world among the international trusts has begun, in which the division of all territories of the globe among the biggest capitalist powers has been completed. Monopolies, oligarchy, the striving for domination and not for freedom, the exploitation of an increasing number of small or weak nations by a handful of the richest or most powerful nations, all these have given birth to those distinctive characteristics of imperialism which compel us to define it as parasitic or decaying capitalism. On the whole, capitalism is growing far more rapidly than before. But this growth is not only becoming more and more uneven in general, its unevenness also manifests itself in particular in the decay of the countries which are richest in capital." End quote.
Wow. So he wrote that back in the early 20th century, I think it was like 1916. And it really just describes the world today. Monopolies, oligarchy, striving for domination.
While they're decaying, while these economies are decaying from the inside.
Exactly. The richest countries are decaying. Mm-hmm. Wow. Lenin was a pretty smart guy.
That's why he's so popular.
Yeah. Popular among...
among...
the working class.
Marxists.
Yes. Once again, another Marxist economist, Rosa Luxemburg, wrote about late-stage capitalism and militarism in her work, The Accumulation of Capital. She actually wrote this even earlier than Lenin wrote Imperialism. She said, quote, "Militarism fulfills a quite definite function in the history of capital, accompanying, as it does, every historical phase of accumulation. It plays a decisive part in the first stages of European capitalism, in the period of the so-called primitive accumulation, as a means of conquering the New World and the spice-producing countries of India. Later, it is employed to subject the modern colonies, to destroy the social organizations of primitive societies, so that their means of production may be appropriated forcibly to introduce commodity trade in countries where the social structure had been unfavorable to it, and to turn the natives into a proletariat by compelling them to work for wages in the colonies. It is responsible for the creation and expansion of spheres of interest for European capital in non-European regions, for extorting railway concessions in backward countries, and for enforcing the claims of European capital as international lender. Finally, militarism is a weapon in the competitive struggle between capitalist countries for areas of non-capitalist civilization." End quote.
So I know we're throwing a lot of theory at you right now, but we just think it's super important to understand that this, you know, the situation of imperialism and militarism has been written about by Marxists for more than a century. And then more recently, We have in 1966, getting back to Paul Sweezy and Paul Baran's book, Monopoly Capitalism, Paul Sweezy explained, quote, "From its earliest beginnings in the Middle Ages, capitalism has always been an international system. It has always been a hierarchical system with one or more leading metropolises at the top, completely dependent colonies at the bottom, and many degrees of superordination and subordination in between. These features are of crucial importance to the functioning of both the system as a whole and its individual components, though this is a fact that bourgeois economists have consistently ignored or denied, and even some Marxists have underestimated," end quote.
Basically, what Paul Sweezy and Paul Baran are saying here is that wealth at the top requires poverty at the bottom.
Basic law of capitalism.
Yes, absolutely. And this is true whether we're talking about the difference between the CEO of a company and its lowest paid worker, or the richest empire in the world and its poorest colonies.
Right. And as capitalism expands, so does the wealth concentrate into smaller and smaller monopolies at the top, while the poor just gets more and more numerous at the bottom. And that's what we're seeing all over the world. We've been talking about that in Israel. We see that in the United States. That's how capitalism works.
Yeah, it's an international global system of exploitation.
Yep. So we've talked about various Marxist theorists here who understand capitalism's relationship to imperialism. So now let's go back and look at two of the most capitalist countries in the world, the United States and Israel. Both of these countries are settler colonial nations that have violently killed, repressed, and expelled the indigenous people on these lands. We've talked about on this podcast how capitalism always requires war and how it requires constant conflict in order to expand its markets. Because capitalism relies on an endless growth model, in other words, if it doesn't grow, it dies, this political economic system has to maintain the constant expansion of markets in order to dominate more and more territory and economy.
Yeah, and it needs to constantly dominate and acquire these new markets in order to continue.
To maintain itself.
Yeah, it can't reach stasis. Stasis is the death of capitalism. It must always be expanding, dominating, and acquiring new land, wealth, and control of resources. Which in this day and age, in which the capitalist countries have spread throughout the world, means constant imperial wars, imperialist conflict.
Constant war.
And it's always meant constant war. You know, that this is the history of capitalism, is the history of war. The United States is both the most capitalist and the most warlike society on Earth. This country has been at war for 230 out of 245 years of existence. And even those, you know, 15 years that were peaceful were rife with conflict at home, class conflict at home and abroad. You know, it wasn't officially at war, but they were still carrying out their imperialist ambitions.
Right. And all we have to do is look at the birth of the United States and the birth of capitalism here on this continent. And we can see that capitalism was born from stolen land and through the genocide of indigenous peoples all over the Americas. And we also know that the rapid expansion of the U.S. empire was fueled first by slavery and then later by other terrible forms of exploitation, like not having to pay a fair wage for economic growth. I mean, this is how the United States gained a decisive political edge over and above other developing capitalist nations.
Yeah, Marx wrote that capitalism was not only born in blood, it came into the world, quote, dripping from head to toe from every pore with blood and dirt, end quote. While the genocidal wars at home against indigenous peoples, as well as slavery, are still barely taught in U.S. public schools. You know, the wars of imperialist expansion that accompanied the growth of the U.S. capitalist system have been well documented, even by bourgeois historians. And you know, these historians largely ignore the link between politics and economy that Marx established, but they do admit that war is simply a continuation of U.S. politics by other means. Therefore, you know, logically, it follows that if politics is an aspect of the economic system, then so is war.
So even mainstream historians have had to acknowledge that war is a constant feature of the U.S. political system. And it's never really questioned in our public education, our indoctrination systems, why there should be so many wars. It's just kind of taken for granted, like, oh, of course, there was World War I, then there was World War II, and then we had all these other wars all over the world. And these wars just happened because the United States, in its ever-benevolent kindness and generosity, has needed to expand democracy all over the world.
Yeah. I mean, that really isn't far from what we hear every day from the corporate mainstream media, you know.
And from our government. Selling us the newest and latest war. You know, we have to expand democracy somewhere else. Here we go again, expanding democracy.
Yeah. But, you know, in reality, what we're expanding was the capitalist system. And it's not a coincidence that the greatest years of capitalist expansion have also seen the bloodiest wars and genocides. Mm-hmm. You know, the genocides carried out by the colonists in the Americas, Africa, and Asia, especially in India. These were all done to expand the capitalist mode of production. As Marx and Engels told us in the Communist Manifesto way back in 1848, quote, "The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere," end quote.
Yep. So capitalism has to keep growing or die, kind of like cancer.
Yeah. Yeah, lot like cancer.
A lot like cancer, actually.
A cancerous economic system.
Yeah, it's actually destroying the planet, destroying the body of its host. So we know that Christopher Columbus came to the, quote, New World for profit motives, and he was financed not based on any scientific interest in learning about the New World, but because there were riches to be made here. Columbus came looking for commodities, and he came looking for gold. And he was going to take it by any means necessary.
Yes, and his search for commodities included the indigenous people themselves. You know, those who weren't brought back to Europe as slaves were murdered or forced to labor. Natives who did not pay tribute to Columbus had their hands cut off. You know, this was a genocide for profit, the very discovery of the New World. You know, since the arrival of Columbus, the entire history of the Americas has been one of conquest and genocide. And fast forward to today, over 500 years later, it's continuing. The U.S. government is approving projects like the Enbridge Line 3 and the Dakota Access Pipeline, which go across indigenous ancestral homelands.
Yeah, we know that to colonizers and capitalists, indigenous peoples become a, quote, surplus population. And if they cannot be used for profits, then capitalists see them as worthless. And they need to either expel them or exterminate them. The political result is first dehumanization as a justification for genocide. And the same process is taking place in Israel right now.
Yeah, knowing how this, you know, how the capitalist system works, I often wonder, how can a civilized society possibly defend this economy?
Through propaganda and trying to convince us that it is something other than what it actually is. But this is what it is. And we are living in the Dark Ages. So these are the material conditions. Like we said at the beginning, you know, we're interested in historical materialism. And these are the material conditions that make genocide favorable for the ruling classes in both Israel and the United States. Gaza, as a refugee or prison camp, does not offer opportunities for profit. However, razing Gaza to the ground and driving out the 2+ million people living there does make that area a ripe domain for capitalist expansion.
And we can see this recently in a global newspaper. An Israeli real estate agent has faced backlash after posting images online advertising beachfront villas in war-torn Gaza.
God.
The photo in the ad, which I hope you can all look it up and see it. You know, it shows a blueprint of several extremely modern style homes juxtaposed on top of buildings that have been bombed into rubble. Yeah, the author of this ad, Hare Zahav, posted this image on his social media channels with a message reading, quote, "Wake up, a house on the beach is not a dream," end quote.
That is so gross. I've seen the image and it literally has these like super modern looking sketches of houses on top of rubble, like right on top of rubble, like right on top of the mass graves of thousands and thousands of children.
Yeah, they don't show all the dead children in the rubble.
No.
But it's, we know.
We know what's under there. Yeah.
And, these beachfront villas, they may never happen, but this is the kind of sick plan that capitalists have come up with during an act of genocide.
That is so gross.
Yeah, they didn't even wait for, this bombing campaign to end. Like, during the bombing, they're already advertising, hey, look, you can get a beachfront villa in Gaza.
That is sick.
For capitalists, this genocide is simply an investment opportunity.
Just like we've been saying. It's just so sick to see it in real time. So sick. So in our second Palestine episode, we talked extensively about Netanyahu's plan for a canal and a corridor. Remember that?
Yep, I remember. Yeah.
To connect Israel to all of the Middle East. Well, he presented this plan to the United Nations. I just think this timing is so amazing. He presented this plan in September of 2023, just a few weeks before the Hamas attacks of October 7th. Do you think that timing is a coincidence?
I don't think so. There's no way.
Yeah. So just to refresh your memories, here is Netanyahu again making that proposal.
2 weeks ago, we saw another blessing already in sight. In the G20 conference, President Biden, Prime Minister Modi, and European and Arab leaders announced plans for a visionary corridor that will stretch across the Arabian Peninsula and Israel. It will connect India to Europe with maritime links, rail links, energy pipelines, fiber optic cables. This corridor will bypass maritime choke points, and dramatically lower the cost of goods, communication, and energy for over 2 billion people. What a historic change for my country.
And then Netanyahu holds up a map for all of us to see. And curiously, Gaza is missing from this map. And this corridor, which he's drawn on the map, runs right through what would be, or used to be, Gaza.
Today I bring this marker to show a great blessing. The blessing of a new Middle East between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and our other neighbors. We will not only bring down barriers between Israel and our neighbors.
Barriers such as Gaza.
We'll build a new corridor of peace and prosperity.
Now that all the indigenous people of this land are dead or displaced.
That connects Asia through the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, to Europe. This is an extraordinary change, a monumental change, another pivot of history.
So that was Netanyahu, the butcher of Gaza, proposing his corridor that will change the landscape of the entire region. And, in addition to this proposed corridor going through the rubble, Israel has been auctioning off natural gas exploration licenses off the coast of Gaza. There is estimated to be 3 billion barrels of oil beneath the Mediterranean just off Gaza and the West Bank of Palestine.
Which also explains why we're seeing so much violence on the West Bank. This isn't just happening to Gaza. And why is none of this surprising?
It seems like every time the U.S. is involved in the Middle East, it's over access to oil reserves.
Mm-hmm. Shireen Talat, founder and director of MENOF, which stands for Movement for Economic Development and Ecological Justice, said, quote, "This genocide is not about the claims of Israel protecting itself. This genocide is about oil," end quote. So lots of people see it.
So guess what? One of the corporations, these multinational corporations, is U.S.-based Chevron, who is involved in extracting natural gas from 3 separate locations in Israel or off the shore of Israel, including the Leviathan Basin Project.
Israel has also attracted significant investment in its tech sector. Big surprise. Quote, Intel, which currently employs 11,700 people in Israel, is the country's largest private employer. Over the last 50 years, it has built 4 development centers in Israel and invested more than $50 billion in the country, according to the company, end quote. And that quote is from the New York Times. And Intel's latest project is a $25 billion plant expansion in southern Israel.
Wow. So that's just 2 of these, you know, U.S. corporations, these transnational capitalist corporations that have interest in maintaining Israel as a state. And the fact that Israel is carrying out a genocide right now doesn't stop them from continuing to invest in Israel. And this genocide opens up new opportunities for profit with Netanyahu's plans for a new economic corridor where the Gazan people once lived.
Right. I mean, it's like fucking Wild West. Manifest destiny.
Yeah. Just go out, steal the land, kill the inhabitants of the land. And back then it was put a railroad through it. Now it's put a corridor that might be railroad, canals, infrastructure, all that.
Yep. And of course, the U.S. political class is heavily invested in these capitalist expansionist projects as well. Beyond whatever direct investments they have in Israel's future developments, they've built their careers around cash from Israeli lobbyists. Joe Biden, for example, has received $4,346,264 from the Israeli lobby since 1990.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. No wonder he's a Zionist. In 2024, pro-Israel groups have already spent over $10 million, with 60% of it going to Democrats, folks. 60% to Democrats. In 2022, they spent almost $44 million, which was a record amount.
And it looks like, you know, the 2024 cycle is going to just blow that out of the water,
oh,
since
of
they've
course.
Already spent over $10 million, and we're still, you know, the election's in November. Oh, wow.
Yep.
And of course, it's not just Democrats. Like you said, it's only 60% going to the Democrats. So the Republicans are also vying for this big money from the AIPAC lobby.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play here a recent Democracy Now! Clip from the 3rd Republican primary debate in November 2023. And we know some of these people have already dropped out now, but it's still, you know, entirely relevant to understand, you know, where the Republicans stand on this issue.
On Wednesday night, the Republican Party held its 3rd presidential debate in Miami. Former President Donald Trump refused to take part and opted to hold a nearby rally. 5 Republicans were on stage: Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former South Carolina Governor and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, and biotech investor Vivek Ramaswamy. The debate began with a question about Israel. This is NBC's Lester Holt.
As President of the United States, what would you be urging Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to do at this moment? Governor DeSantis.
I would be telling Bibi, finish the job once and for all with these butchers, Hamas. They're terrorists. They're massacring innocent people. They would wipe every Jew off the globe if they could. He cannot live with that threat right by his country. The Hamas should release every hostage, and they should unconditionally surrender. I'm sick of hearing the media. I'm sick of hearing other people blame Israel just for defending itself. We will stand with Israel in word and in deed, in public and in private.
Ambassador Haley, what would you do? What would you be urging Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to do? Would you consider humanitarian pause, for example?
The first thing I said to him when it happened was, I said, finish them. Finish them. And the reason is, I worked on this every day when I was at the United Nations. And we have to remember that they have to, 1, eliminate Hamas, 2, support Israel with whatever they need, whenever they need it, and 3, make sure we bring our hostages home. We need to be very clear-eyed to know there would be no Hamas without Iran. There would be no Hezbollah without Iran. There would not be the Houthis without Iran. And there wouldn't be the Iranian militias in Syria and Iraq that are trying to hit our military men and women if it hadn't been for Iran. And who is funding Iran right now? China is buying oil from Iran. Russia is getting drones and missiles from Iran. And there is an unholy alliance. We need to be clear-eyed. The last thing we need to do is to tell Israel what to do. The only thing we should be doing is supporting them and eliminating Hamas. It is not that Israel Israel needs America. America needs Israel. They are the tip of the spear when it comes to this Islamic terrorism, and we need to make sure that we have their backs in that process.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Ramaswamy. Mr. Ramaswamy, any daylight between you and the candidates we just heard on this issue on what you would tell the prime minister?
Not in terms of what I would tell the prime minister, no. In fact, I would go one step further. The founding vision of Israel was based on the idea that they don't want to depend on anybody else's sympathy or direction in defending themselves. So what I would tell Bibi is that Israel has the right and the responsibility to defend itself. I would tell him to smoke those terrorists on his southern border, and then I'll tell him as president of the United States, I'll be smoking the terrorists on our southern border.
Smoke them out of their holes. Reminds me of George Bush.
Yeah, the good news is Vivek Ramaswamy will not be president. He's already dropped out.
Right.
But you can see he was really trying to out-fascist the rest of the fascists.
Yeah, I mean, this is just... this rhetoric is just so typical of the Republican Party. You just have these, like, three everyday fascists competing for who can be the most vitriolic asshole on the face of the earth.
Yeah, and of course, Trump wasn't even there, but we know he has very similar rhetoric when it comes to the Israel situation.
Yeah.
He loves himself some genocide as well.
Right. But, you know, as we were just talking about a second ago, pro-Israel groups gave 60% of their money to Democrats, and we see who's financially backing and sending all of these weapons for this genocide right now. So really, it's only a difference in rhetoric. It's both parties. The United States and Israel are in bed with each other. They have been for decades, decades and decades and decades. And it doesn't matter that a plurality of voters, some 80% of registered Democrats, and almost 60% of registered Republicans are saying in polls that they want a ceasefire now, it doesn't matter. The money is in the weapons industry, and so the United States will continue arming Israel come hell or high water.
And this is a historical thing. The U.S. has spent more on foreign aid for Israel than any other country in the world. This small, little, illegitimate state on the corner of the Mediterranean there is tiny little state. They get more money from the United States than any other country. And Israel is described as being, quote, the most militarized nation in the world, end quote, by the Global Militarization Index. And the United States is currently giving Israel $3.8 billion in military aid every year. And Biden has proposed another $14.3 billion.
Yep.
And of course, you know, this proposal has still yet to pass Congress, a Republican-led Congress. And since it's, you know, stalled there, the Biden regime has simply gone around and bypassed Congress twice to sell weapons to Israel, including artillery and tank ammunition. And the total of these two sales has been over $250 million. So, you know, not a lot compared to the $14.3 billion that's proposed. Here's Ralph Nader talking about that.
The Congress is basically a rubber stamp and doesn't even have public hearings as it shovels billions of dollars to Israel. And it's about to pass, unless Bernie Sanders and others who are opposed, a $14.3 billion, with a B, dollar appropriation for Israel, military arms, and other aspects of the Israeli right-wing regime's priorities. And that $14.3 billion is larger than the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's 20 times the budget of the Occupational Safety and Health Agency. It's four times the budget of the National Park Service, which has 300 million visitors. So there is rising opposition to it in the Congress, mostly among Democrats, but not enough.
Yeah, we know how well the resistance goes over when it's headed by Bernie Sanders and the squad. You know, Bernie Sanders didn't even call for a ceasefire for about the first 2 months of this genocide.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even the squad has been, you know, like there's documentaries on how AOC has been basically bought out by AIPAC, that she was approached by them and they said, you know, you either toe the line and you say these things and we'll give you this money, or we will spend the same amount of money against you if you do not say these things. And so their positions have changed over time. So when you have this level of corruption inside the Congress, resistance is futile through any kind of electoral means. And, you know, in addition to Congress rubber stamping everything that Israel wants, there's a whole other component to this, that the United States has long funded Israel also because Israel uses Gaza as a weapons laboratory. And that's been going on long before this recent bombardment, but it's also completely connected to capitalism and profit.
And this is something that sociology professor William I. Robinson has talked about. The following is an excerpt from his book, Global Police State. Quote, "The occupied Palestinian territory has been transformed into probably the most monitored, controlled, and militarized place on earth. It epitomizes the dream of every general, security expert, and police officer to be able to exercise total biopolitical control. In a situation where the local population enjoys no effective legal protections or privacy, they and their lands become a laboratory where the latest technologies of surveillance, control, and suppression are perfected and showcased, giving Israel an edge in the highly competitive global market. Labels such as, quote, combat proven, quote, tested in Gaza, and, quote, approved by the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, on Israeli or foreign products greatly improves their marketability. These methods of control and repression, fine-tuned against the Palestinians, have been exported by Israel to racist police in U.S. inner cities, Brazilian security forces that patrol the impoverished residents of the Rio favelas, Colombian and Guatemalan military and paramilitary forces in their battles against social movements, Central Asian intelligence officers monitoring human rights activists and journalists, Chinese army agents developing domestic systems of social control, and corporate clients and repressive states and police agencies the world over," end quote.
On this same topic, here's renowned investigative journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein on Israel's laboratory in Gaza.
How does Israel use Palestine as a weapons laboratory?
The Palestine laboratory is essentially the way that Israel has monetized the longest occupation in modern times. So Israel's been occupying Palestinian territory for over half a century. And in that time, they have developed a huge range of tools and technologies to repress Palestinians and maintain that occupation. Israel promotes and sells these tools as so-called battle-tested.
Global demand for new Israeli weapons spikes after they're tested during attacks on Gaza.
Israel uses footage that they have filmed themselves in Gaza or elsewhere and shows that to potential foreign clients.
Countries also buy Israeli surveillance technology like spyware, facial recognition, and biometric tools. These technologies are tested and used by Israel in its occupation of Gaza and the West Bank.
The occupation has become essentially a key form of disaster capitalism.
Israel is the world's 10th largest weapons exporter. It sells arms and surveillance tech to an estimated 130 countries. Israeli arms companies like Elbit Systems are able to position themselves uniquely on the global stage by marketing their weaponry as battle-proven and field-tested.
Israel's arms industry is really an insurance policy of sorts. And what I mean by that is that lots of nations around the world may not like the occupation of Palestine, might not feel comfortable with Palestinians being repressed or colonized, but ultimately they actually want Israeli repressive tech to repress their own people.
I'm a little bit speechless. That was so sick. And you know what it reminds me of is the Holocaust and the experimentation on Jewish prisoners in the Holocaust. How all those crazy Nazi scientists were always like, you know, sawing off people's, you know, taking out people's organs or like experimenting on Jewish prisoners to see how they would react or what organs they could live without, or experimenting with test medicines on giving them diseases and then experimenting with cures. And I mean, just an effing laboratory.
Yeah, weapons laboratory. They're just testing methods of killing people. It's awful.
And then selling selling that technology to other countries for profit.
Yep, that's capitalism.
And using the Palestinians as guinea pigs, as fucking guinea pigs in this war industry. I mean, I'm just like, does this translate into any kind of war crime with the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice? Because this is like beyond the pale.
Yeah, if it doesn't, it definitely should be illegal to, I mean, there's no way it's not a war crime to test weapons on an occupied territory.
Yeah, on an imprisoned occupied territory. Unbelievable.
So here's the rest of that clip.
So-called normalization deals with Israel in the last years. Essentially, those deals were arms deals. Its influence on global affairs and the arms industry is almost unprecedented.
Israel has supported genocidal and apartheid regimes across the world for decades. From the 1970s, Israel sold weapons to the South African apartheid government. Starting in the 80s, Israel supplied weapons to right-wing US-backed death squads in El Salvador. In the 90s, Israel provided weapons to Serbian forces during the Bosnian genocide. And Israeli weapons were allegedly used during the Rwandan genocide. More recently, Israel sold weapons and surveillance tech to Myanmar, even after the UN said its military leaders should face trial for genocide against the Rohingya population.
People need to understand that the occupation of Palestine is not staying there. It's actually being exported around the world. So it's bad enough for Palestinians in Palestine, 50 plus years of brutal occupation, but in fact those tools and technologies and ideologies are being exported to vast parts of the world. So whether you live in New York or London or Dhaka or Delhi, almost certainly as a citizen you'll be impacted by some form of Israeli repressive technology, and that's something we should all oppose.
Yeah, so it's not bad enough that the United States is arming Israel for the genocide, but Israel is also creating weapons to arm other genocidal regimes.
And they have been for decades and decades.
And the U.S. is fully complicit in this, and the U.S. buys some of these weapons, I'm sure. It's a, you know, this is international capitalism. These weapons are being exported to 130 countries.
And these are our U.S. tax dollars. This is that $4 billion per year that goes to Israel.
Yeah, it's helping to fund the whole Israel capitalist machine of military accumulation. Once again, they're selling weapons for profit.
So Lowenstein's work is so groundbreaking, and there's a lot of leftists who have been commenting on the Palestine laboratory issue have been citing his work, and it, you know, it's caused me to research a little bit more. For example, how all of the dirty wars throughout Central America in the 1970s and 80s, a lot of those wars were using Israeli arms and support. There were all of these genocidal death squads that were involved in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Honduras, in Nicaragua. And, you know, I've always known that these were U.S.-backed death squads, but it's not until just recently, because of what's happening in Palestine, have I learned that Israel has such a hand in helping to arm these dirty wars throughout Central America in the 1970s and 80s, including arming the Contras before the Sandinista Revolution. So for all of these decades, Israel has been seen as the leading counterinsurgent entity that has provided arms and technologies to so many of these massacres and genocides. And in some cases, like in Guatemala, U.S. and Israeli-backed death squads were responsible for the deaths of some 200,000 indigenous Mayans.
Now, they're just continuing this legacy of arming genocide. In this case, it's now just Israel carrying out the genocide themselves, and the United States is arming them. And the United States, they went around their own Congress to arm Israel, and they also, it reminds me of how they also went against their own laws to arm Nazis in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
There was a 2018 House resolution that, you know, U.S. Congressperson Ro Khanna sponsored and seems to have forgotten about now, that banned sending weapons to the Azov battalion in Ukraine. And, you know, this is something we've talked about in our Ukraine episodes. I don't want to get too much into it, but arming Israel and arming Ukraine is also in violation of the Leahy Act, which expressly says the United States cannot arm regimes that are carrying out war crimes.
Right.
Yeah, this is why the U.S. has used Israel as a proxy before to do some of its dirty work, because it was, you know, it was illegal to arm some of these death squads back in the 80s as well.
Right. The U.S. would otherwise look like a giant effing hypocrite, which it is, but it would transparently appear to be what it is if it didn't have Israel to go around and do a lot of this dirty work kind of undercover, like as if one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. Oof. What a lethal marriage of empires. It is just really sick. So over the last few years, Amnesty International and Jewish Voice for Peace have been publishing reports also detailing how Israeli training of U.S. police officers has resulted in systematic brutality of people inside the United States. Big surprise. Amnesty International's report cites, quote, widespread constitutional violations, discriminatory enforcement, and a culture of retaliation, end quote, within the Baltimore Police Department, for example. And JVP's report went on to say that, quote, police brutality of the kind that led to the death of George Floyd is both deeply embedded in American policing and also reinforced by the exchange of, quote, best practices and expertise in counterterrorism techniques taught to U.S. law enforcement officials during their training in Israel. Thousands of these officials from across the United States have been sent to Israel for training, and thousands more have participated in conferences and workshops with Israeli personnel, end quote. And then the Middle East Monitor writes that, quote, George Floyd's killing is the latest but probably not the last example of classic American policing to mirror Israel's, quote, best law enforcement practice. It is being put to deadly use on the streets of America. And if Black lives really do matter in the 21st century, then the deadly exchange programs with Israel should be brought to an end without delay, end quote.
These police killings have not stopped under Biden. He ran on being able to do something about Black Lives Matter,
right,
about police brutality. And under Biden, police murders have actually risen.
Wow.
And he obviously hasn't ended this training program with Israel. This is an economic, political, and military marriage between the U.S. and Israel.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And Biden has bragged about this relationship for years, saying, quote, if there were not an Israel, we'd have to invent an Israel, end quote. This is the kind of fascist project between two hyper-militarized settler colonial empires that has led to the green lighting of genocide in the current moment and in the past against all public opinion.
Yeah. And this is why Biden's approval ratings are tanking.
Yeah, he's down to 33%, I believe, now. This is a little bit older article than at the time of recording, but I just want to quote from a Seattle Times article. It says, quote, voters broadly disapprove of the way President Joe Biden is handling the bloody strife between Israelis and Hamas. A New York Times/Siena College poll has found, with younger Americans far more critical than older voters of both Israel's conduct and of the administration's response to the war in the Gaza Strip. Overall, registered voters say they favor Trump over Biden in next year's presidential election by 2 percentage points, 46% to 44%. The president's job approval rating has slid to 37%, down 2 points from July. But there is considerable uncertainty over whether disaffected voters will even vote, end quote.
So you're saying that his approval rating has slipped even further since then?
Yeah, it's down to 33% now, so another 4% in like less than a month since this article came out.
Well, there you have it. You know, this is what pushes people over to Trump. And this is how the corrupt corporate uniparty works, with an almost identical policy agenda when it comes to foreign policy, which just pushes us as a country further and further towards global fascism. So again, back to the analysis of modern-day Marxist sociologist William I. Robinson of UC Santa Barbara. He kind of ties it all together, Lenin, Luxembourg, Sweezy, and brings it back to 21st century fascism. the topic of this episode. Remember Robinson's triangle form for fascism. 3 points coming together. Transnational capital, reactionary political power in the state, and neo-fascist forces in civil society. Robinson often refers to the economic aspect of fascism as, quote, the dictatorship of transnational capital, end quote. Dictatorship because global capitalism sets the agenda and often sets government policies based on their financial interests in the spoils of war. As we've seen in Palestine, the oil companies, the weapons manufacturers, big tech, spyware, all of these transnational corporations that are part of the military-industrial complex have had a huge hand in how this genocide goes, in how long it goes, and if or when it will be stopped. To borrow some words from award-winning novelist Arundhati Roy, quote, "Once weapons were manufactured to fight wars, now wars are manufactured to sell weapons," end quote. This is the nature of 21st century fascism.
Yeah, going back to another article of Robinson's that we've put it before, entitled "Global Capitalism Has Become Dependent on War-Making to Sustain Itself," Robinson writes, quote, "Militarized accumulation refers to a situation in which a global war economy relies on the state to organize war-making, social control, and repression to sustain capital accumulation in the face of chronic stagnation and saturation of global markets. These state-organized practices are outsourced to transnational corporate capital, involving the fusion of private accumulation with state militarization in order to sustain the process of capital accumulation," end quote.
Right. And as you read this, I'm thinking about Israel's Canal Corridor project. I mean, think of all the international investment opportunities there would be to build this canal.
Yeah, we already mentioned a few of those.
Yeah. All the new infrastructure that Bibi discussed himself, rail links, energy pipelines, fiber optic cables for over 2 million people. But in order to secure the land for this project, they have to flatten Gaza to the ground first. And that's where the military profits come in. On October 9th, as Israel's bombardment of Gaza began, military stock prices surged. Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and General Dynamics all saw their stocks surge. Lockheed Martin was up more than 8%, while Northrop Grumman climbed more than 11%, on track for its largest percentage increase since March of 2020. And European defense industry stocks surged as well. So capitalism is an economic system that profits off war, and in this case, off genocide.
Yeah, well, I just realized that March 2020 was when Bernie dropped out, essentially.
Oh, wow.
So that was their last time it soared so much, when it was when they realized that Biden was going to be the nominee, so it was either going to be Biden or Trump.
Ugh, that makes a lot of sense. That's so pathetic. Ugh.
Yeah, the, of course, war stocks surged when they discovered that their boy Biden was going to be the nominee.
Right.
Also, it's noteworthy that this was a greater gain than even on the news of the start of the Ukraine war.
Wow. Is it really greater stock gain than at the beginning of the Ukraine war?
It said Northrop Grumman climbed more than, it was the largest percentage increase since
2020.
March 2020. Yep. So, yeah, that's pretty impressive that this genocide resulted in the investors being like, woohoo, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, these are, you know, as Lenin said, capitalist horrors without end.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure some of you have seen these videos and pictures coming out of Palestine, which are just, they're horrific.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I think most people are watching this live streaming on their Instagram and Twitter, and most people that I know.
Yeah, and we've only seen a little bit of it because they don't even have access to internet most of the time over there.
Right.
This is a genocide of children, and... yeah, noteworthy is that the mainstream media isn't showing us these pictures or videos.
Of course not.
They're providing cover for this genocidal project.
That's what the corporate media does. It's basically a public relations arm for the Pentagon.
William Robinson goes on to say that the next part of the fascist project is to bring down state control against those who are discontented with the system. He says, quote, "There is a convergence in the process of global capitalism's political need for social control and repression in the face of mounting popular discontent worldwide and its economic need to perpetuate accumulation in the face of stagnation. End quote.
Yeah, this is the subject of his book, Global Police State. And basically, this is why so much of the budgets of police are increasing as well, because it's a profit opportunity to clamp down on all of the discontent that's happening all over the world. And this translates directly into repression of the working class. In Western Europe after World War I, it translated into the repression of communists, socialists, trade unionists, and Jews. We always hear about the Jews in the Holocaust, but we don't hear as much about the repression of communists, socialists, and trade unionists.
First, they came for the socialists.
Right.
And we can see more signs of this growing authoritarianism, this kind of fascism coming home here in the United States with the criminalization of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in 37 states. This is that repression that Robinson was talking about. It's illegal to support BDS.
Yeah. In 37 states, it's become illegal to have free speech. So basically, AIPAC at this point has more free speech rights than U.S. citizens, since we're not allowed to boycott or divest or sanction or protest what Israel is doing. On top of silencing our peaceful protests, AIPAC is planning to spend around $100 million in this next election cycle to oppose members of Congress who are calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. A ceasefire. A ceasefire.
Yeah, just a ceasefire.
Just a ceasefire.
Not a Palestinian state.
Not a revolution.
Not a free Palestine.
Just a ceasefire. And AIPAC is routinely spending hundreds of millions of dollars to make sure that the Israeli lobby owns our Congress.
Right. And at the same time, the House passed a resolution equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism in order to make it even more politically taboo to speak out against Israel.
God, here you have the Israeli-U.S. marriage at work. They're getting so desperate. They're passing laws to try to keep us from speaking out against Israel. Our own government is passing resolutions. And then we have this major clampdown on free speech on college campuses. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about the latest scandal, all these political firings, intimidations of university presidents, like the president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, the first African-American president of Harvard, as well as the presidents of UPenn and MIT. A right-wing congresswoman and a Trump supporter interrogated these three presidents for permitting free speech on their college campuses, claiming that phrases like Intifada until victory or from the river to the sea were calls for the genocide of Jews. Ironically, as we know, Netanyahu just has been talking about from the river to the sea in terms of advocating the complete and total genocide of Palestinians.
But that's okay for Netanyahu.
That's fine for him.
Not for protesters. Not
for measly students. Yeah. Measly students can't say anything. And from every Palestinian group I've been a part of, when they talk about from the river to the sea, they're talking about equal rights for Palestine from the river to the sea. They're not talking about the genocide of Jews. That's a total projection from a very genocidal state to suggest that people who want their freedom are actually calling for the genocide of other people. Anyway, in early 2024, after these terrible interrogations, Harvard President Claudine Gay stepped down from her position after she revealed that she faced death threats and was repeatedly called the N-word in recent weeks as a right-wing effort to oust her intensified over the handling of campus protests and her past academic research. And of course, the accusations were that she was anti-Semitic for not ousting students who protested Israel's genocide. Claudine Gay had become Harvard's first Black president just 6 months ago.
Well, this wasn't even about Israel and Palestine. This was also racism, so it sounds like to me. It wasn't like she was even saying from the river to the sea. It was just protesters.
Oh, no. She definitely wasn't saying that. But the woman, I can't remember her name, the Trump supporter that interrogated all these presidents, as soon as the UPenn president and Claudine Gay stepped down, she kept tweeting, okay, 2 out of 3.
Jeez. So, while these college presidents are being crucified for permitting free speech on their campuses, that these right-wingers are claiming, say, supports genocide of the Jews, when in reality it just calls for liberation of the Palestinian people. Israel is actually committing genocide in Gaza. And that's perfectly acceptable for the mainstream media. It's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't even cover the South Africa's case against them. They only covered Israel's defense.
Right. Yeah. Israel's actually committing genocide in Gaza. The U.S. The U.S. representatives at the United Nations are blocking a ceasefire, raising their bloody hands to block the ceasefire. The corporate media won't cover that, but not students and not universities permitting free speech on campuses. No, no, no. And not surprisingly, it turns out that one of the main masterminds behind President Gay's ouster is none other than Christopher Ruffaut.
Hey, I remember him.
You remember him? Who we covered extensively on this podcast when he launched a very profitable culture war against teaching critical race theory. Quote unquote, critical race theory. Of course, he has no idea what that is. But here he is again, and he was able to intimidate President Gay into stepping down with the help of the Israeli lobby.
Yeah, I'm sure he's making bank from the Israeli lobby for carrying out this campaign.
Oh, absolutely.
We know he's a real grifter. He likes to make money off of all his campaigns.
Yeah, yeah.
Once again, we're seeing this political and economic marriage of Zionists with right-wing movements and U.S. government officials.
Yep.
We have lobbyists, right-wing ideologues, and the state all merging together to create this new breed of Western fascism.
Mm-hmm.
This repression of Palestinian solidarity and the frontal attacks against free speech, careers being destroyed by AIPAC, weaponizing people's humanitarian concerns and calling it anti-Semitism, which we're seeing not only in the U.S. but in Western Europe as well. The AIPAC mafia is strong. It's international as well. This isn't just a U.S. thing.
Right. And it's just so ironic. Palestinians, from a political and economic standpoint, are in much the same position that Jews were in the 1930s when they were being dehumanized, blamed, and scapegoated for all of Germany's economic woes. And here today, it's Palestinians who are standing in the way of European, Zionist, and economic progress. So the tables have turned. But capitalism, imperialism, and fascism are just finding new people to subjugate in their constant expansion of markets. And it's such an ugly hypocrisy when people who actually understand something about trauma, the trauma of the Holocaust, are watching that trauma being weaponized and perverted into a justification for another genocide. It's just so unreal. So given all of this analysis, what should our resistance look like?
Well, clearly we haven't been voting hard enough.
All about voting. We just got to get those voters out.
Vote harder.
Vote blue no matter who.
No matter who genocides.
Vote for the lesser evil. Oh, God. No. Both Israel and the United States are settler colonial projects whose very existence is based on oppressing and replacing its indigenous peoples, as well as repressing popular resistance movements that emerge within their national borders. So we're going to need a lot more than voting to break up the geopolitical marriage of these two capitalist settler empires. Only relentless intersectional and international solidarity movements against white supremacy, transnational capitalism, and settler colonialism have the power to do that.
You mean even if we had more AOCs and Jamal Bowmans? That wouldn't do it?
Yeah, well, given that AOC has changed her position on the AIPAC lobby about 5 times, I'm going to say no.
Okay, I mean, I thought Fetterman was going to be our guy. Yeah, he's gone full Zionist now, but I think...
But he started out so good.
He ran as a progressive.
Yeah.
You know, in all reality, you know, there is a lot of power that the working class has here.
Mm-hmm.
In order to overthrow capitalism, it's going to take a united international workers' movement. More specifically, this genocide could be stopped by just certain segments of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the weapons manufacturing workers and the port workers.
Mm-hmm.
Transportation workers could stop the shipment of weapons to Israel, even if, Biden continues to go around Congress to sell these weapons, someone has to ship them.
Yep.
And the same goes with Ukraine and Saudi Arabia and the dozens of other countries that the U.S. is arming.
Right.
The working class has all of this power. I'm going to play a clip here from the Spectre of Communism podcast.
And I love this clip because it just shows how much power the working class has if it were organized.
Here we go. Spectre of Communism, the podcast of the International Marxist Tendency.
Following the events of October 7th, the Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions put a call out to their class brothers and sisters across the world. And they had three things to say. Firstly, we need the workers of the world to refuse to build weapons destined for Israel. Secondly, to refuse to transport weapons to Israel. And thirdly, to take action against companies involved in the siege of Gaza.
Imagine if the massed ranks of the working class was to say not a single nut, bolt, screw, circuit board or shell is going to leave our shores intended for use against innocent Palestinians. And that's the power that the working class really has.
That really highlights the power that the working class has here if we had a united working class.
Yeah, and obviously there are various levels of resistance. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions is another way to resist. There are public relations campaigns and all of that. But the point of this whole episode is to acknowledge that the first step towards this revolution is understanding that capitalism is at the root of fascism. It's at the root of global wars. It's at the root of police state and all of the authoritarianism that's surrounding us. So we cannot vote our way out of fascism. Only international mass movements against this capitalist war machine can take us where we need to go.
All right. Well, this has been quite the episode.
Yeah, very heavy. Thanks for sticking with us, everyone.
Joe, in honor of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, which was earlier this month, we wanted to end this episode with his voice. You know, he was deeply anti-capitalist and anti-war. Even though liberal revisionists will only ever remember his I Have a Dream speech.
Yep.
He was assassinated for his opposition to the U.S. Empire during the Vietnam War and for helping to organize the working class.
Yep. The sanitation workers and his working class solidarity as well as his anti-war sentiments is what ended his life in the end. And his analysis is still so relevant today.
True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It understands that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look at thousands of working people displaced from their jobs with reduced income as a result of automation, while the profits of the employers remain intact, and say, this is not just. It will look across the oceans and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia and Africa only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say, this is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
Yes. Crawdads and Taters is a self-produced and directed production by Aaron McCarley and Burian Sundahl. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Pocket Casts, and Radio Public.